on our net didn't have any further explanation for those insertion losses, and he gave us a whole lot of mathematics for what he thinks is taking place on his line, but it hasn't been confirmed with measurements that we understand. Where on his measurements of the total insertion loss end to end of the system, if you subtract 4 dB of loss for the launchers, you come out with some very desirable sounding numbers. Do the launchers really have that loss? And what's the nature of that loss? So to simply bring him on our TechNet to repeat what he has shown us in those YouTube videos, it's not necessarily going to satisfy me and Roy, for instance, because there's missing information that hasn't yet been explained to us. Over to US N2XJN. Do you think he has done some further experiments to truly explain what really is going on with those launch, with the loss of the launchers? N2XJN, P2RIW.
Hello. My strong belief is that instead of asking what is Joe's name, that Joe say what is his name. In other words, Glenn is fully aware of what he has done and fully aware of how to explain it. He made a number of articles, and just as you said, no question is done, and you're ready to house everybody on this TechNet. And if he would explain it better, what we think we don't have an answer for, that would be beneficial for both of us. Don't you think so?
Wes, do you believe he has an explanation for where the 2 dB of loss on each end on the launchers is coming from? Do you believe he has an explanation for that, that he's really measured, confirmed, in a way that Roy and I can feel comfortable with? Do you think he has that data that he can answer for us? Over to you, Wes.
I believe he has. But for that, we need him to state it. I mean, we have people on the TechNet that are answering, they're asking different questions. We're talking about different stuff. And that would be somehow something new for us. And whatever the answer is, it is still worth the effort. Dr. Roy.
You seem to be in communication with Glenn, N6GN, on a number of occasions. Do you believe he can explain to you where the 2 dB of loss on each end is coming from and how he confirmed it? Do you believe he can tell that to you, Wes? Over to you, Wes.
I didn't ask him his question, but I asked him... hold on, let me go to it. There were three questions that I had. Hold on. For him, that was... can I find it right now? Okay, now. Maybe Dr. Roy pick up and I'm going to find it.
Yeah, I'm looking at a write-up of his, and he uses a term, Klopferstein taper. You know anything about a Klopferstein taper as a form of technology? It's a new term for me, but it sounds like something that's really late 19th, early 20th century.
He was referring to 45, year 1945. 44, a paper from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and there was a name on it.
Okay, it seems to be an impedance matching, tapering material.
When you use a gradual taper, which the classic way of doing that is called a Minerva line, if you've got one impedance of transmission line on the right side and a different impedance of transmission line on the left side, and if in between the two you slowly taper from impedance number one to impedance number two. If the taper is slow enough, and let's say, for instance, you start off with 75 ohm line and you've got 50 ohm line, if the number of ohms per foot of taper is slow enough, that's what the Minerva technique is telling you, then the signal goes through with absolutely no insertion loss and beautiful impedance match. If the taper is slow enough, you can match anything to anything else across a very broad frequency region. It takes up quite a bit of real estate, but the insertion loss is very desirable. Now, if you want to take a Minerva line with a very slow taper and make it much, much smaller, there are various techniques like exponential taper and Gaussian taper, and I can't even think of the names of them. There are various techniques across a narrow frequency region in which you can make the taper much smaller in real estate and still do the job over a limited frequency region. And some of these various tapers have various people's names associated with them. So there's no magic of tapers per se. A quarter wave transmission line is the simplest approach, a quarter wave impedance matching transmission line, and then you can go to a two or three step quarter wave transmission line. We have individual eighth wave steps, so to speak, in order to make it a little bit more broadband. Let me drop.
So I found it. Straton Electromagnetic Theory, MIT, 1941. This was in regards to TEM00, TEM00 is actually crucial in here. That's why I asked you for more explanation.
In the case of waveguide, the most popular way of sending a wave down a rectangular waveguide is called the TE10, sometimes called TE10. Those subscripts, the 1 and the 0, tell you something about the individual components. You could call it the horizontal and vertical component, is one way of looking at it. How many phase reversals are in the horizontal dimension and the vertical dimension. In the case of TE10, you've got a half wave of change in horizontal and zero changes in wave vertical, and that signal bounces back and forth across the narrow walls of the waveguide, and that's the most popular so-called dominant mode of sending a TE wave, a transverse electric wave, down a piece of rectangular waveguide. So subscripts, and by the way, those subscripts, when you go from rectangular guide to round guide, they change the definition of the subscripts. The exact same wave. Let me drop. The exact same wave you send down a rectangular piece of waveguide called TE10. That exact same wave, if I very slowly change the rectangular guide, I go over there with my hammer and I start rounding off the square corners and I slowly taper it into a round piece of waveguide. The exact same wave goes down that taper from the rectangular guide to the round guide. But once it's in the round guide, we don't call it TE10 anymore, we call it TE11 circular. The exact same mode, the exact same ways of bouncing, the exact same transversal and longitudinal component, but because we use a different set of subscripts in round waveguide versus rectangular waveguide, it looks different. TE10 doesn't look like TE11 circular. It is the exact same thing. So you've got to be careful with these subscripts. And now, in the case of his single wire transmission line, is he using the rectangular subscripts? Is he using the circular subscripts? Or is he using some other kind of subscripts? Is an interesting question. When he talks about TE11 or TM11, how is he defining his subscripts?
Yeah, I can give it to you.
Go right ahead.
The wave is described as a TM wave having longitudinal E field from Straton Electromagnetic Theory, MIT, 1941. It is shown that in a very general sense, considering cylindrical media and structures, there are two principal modes, possible TM00 and TM00. Okay. The TM00 mode, normally the only mode considered to exist in common coaxial cable, but in reality, both modes exist as a hybrid. until the impedance is high. The TM00 mode is extremely small. It has been missed entirely until recently. In a vacuum, the wave propagates at sea. I have measured very nearly that in air, in fact, I have made visible measurements of the electric contact air this way. So, it's not go about line, and that's his statement. That's what he said.
When I'm using a coaxial cable transmission line in the conventional manner, that signal going down the line is a pure TEM wave. There is no longitudinal component of E or M in that line in the conventional way of using a coaxial cable. However, if I go to a high enough frequency where the round outer conductor is now above waveguide cutoff and it can support the next waveguide mode simultaneously, that first waveguide mode that happens in your coaxial cable is called TE11 circular. So ordinary coaxial cable will support TE11 circular. And yes, there is a magnetic component in that case for the waveguide mode of coax cable. And I could, if I wanted to, launch both kinds of wave down that cable, TEM and TE11 circular. So that happens in ordinary coax cable when you're at a high enough frequency. Is that what he's saying, Wes? N2XJN, K2LIW?
It's not perfectly clear for me. As it is not very much clear for me that circular breath disc folded and soldered to create 90 degree cone as to what is the diameter? How the diameter of the cone reflects non-radiative parameters of the transmission line. I know that I've changed the subject a little bit, but to
VDH with a comment?
Go right ahead, John.
Yeah, Dick, I think in G line, Cabro line, I think there is an E field that is longitudinal, that is in the direction of the line, and the E field terminates a half wave ahead of the line. In other words, the E field curves out and then comes back to the line a half wave ahead, where there is a 180 degree phase reversal. So in that case, there is an E field component in a direction. So they would call that, I guess, a TM mode. Go ahead.
When that conductor is there, as it is in that G line, the fact that there is a longitudinal component of either E or H, probably E, I can accept that on that particular line. But you're not going to get that into free space. And from what you know, John, do you believe from these experiments that the N6GN has run that he has made a case for either his G line or G-like line, because he doesn't have the normal dielectric there, it's not a pure conventional G line. From what you've heard, do you believe he has so far presented to us a very desirable transmission line for microwave frequencies that we should be considering? Roy and I, and probably some other people, are saying that he's got an interesting experiment, but there's still missing information before I'm willing to climb onto that bandwagon. Maybe you feel the same way, John. The basics of EDH, K2LIW.
From what I know of G-Line, I know that they do have low loss, but I don't. I haven't heard of them operating down into the HF range. I think what Wes said is that he has actually conducted this test down into HF. All I've heard about G-Lines is that they are operating well up into the microwave range. So I don't know about operating down low. And again, there is a question about the launcher. But I do remember reading somewhere that it is a type of quasi-TM mode, because the E-field does terminate all back on the line a half wave ahead. So in that sense, you would have an E-field component in the direction of the line. Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with that. I have a perfect example for it. Maxwell equation, and the waves exist in plasmas in confined spaces, called plasma waves. But doesn't have to be plasma. It has to be confined space, like in Jap. And then it would exist in longitudinal and transverse, or mixture of both. So, question to you, Dick. If we say the diameter of the cone outside is X, whatever, and the other cone is X, and then we have a wire number 28, would you somehow think about a space to be limited, confined, and to exist?
Wes, I hear your words. I don't understand what is the question.
Maybe Dr. Roy would understand me better.
I was reading some of Elmore's stuff. Do you want to repeat the question and I'll try my best?
In the electric fields and magnetic fields, they vary perpendicularly in direction of propagation. However, waves can exist in plasmas or confined spaces called plasma waves, which can be longitudinal, transverse, or mixture of both. Plasma waves can also occur in force-free magnetic field. But I was asking, we have two cones and a wire, and we know that that is transmission line. So we're trying to avoid the radiating. We want to have a transmission. Would you somehow space between cone A and cone B at the end of the wire call confined? Back to you.
No, I wouldn't call that confined. I think you're mixing apples and oranges. The concept is that a TM propagation can take place on a conductive medium like plasma or like a waveguide, but not in free space. So I think the ultimate problem is once you jump into free space, there's no proof whatsoever that you could get a longitudinal electric field. It's going to be transverse. It's going to be a TEM wave. Everything else kind of collapses in on itself because it can't self-propagate.
About Heaviside, he came to the conclusion that electromagnetic waves were not to be found as longitudinal waves, but it would be somehow treated as homogeneous media. So in other words, what is homogeneous media? Dick.
The fact that he's got these two cones facing each other and a piece of wire coming down the center of the two cones, is that a shielded, confined structure? By my definition of the usual methods of measuring electromagnetic interference and electromagnetic compatibility, no, that is not a shielded structure. It is not a confined structure. And if he thinks that he is running into a plasma-like characteristic of this structure, now I strongly disagree with him. There's no plasma involved here because under normal circumstances, you only get a plasma when the materials of the medium are at extremely high temperatures where the electrons separate themselves from the nucleuses of the atoms. So he doesn't have any plasma, he doesn't have good shielding, and therefore, under normal circumstances, this is not a very easy to use transmission line, is my belief. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Other longitudinal modes of resonant cavity.
Roy, did you understand that question?
No, I didn't. And there's a couple of things. I think everyone's mixing up Wikipedia pages. The entry about plasma is simply in one of the Wikipedia pages, I believe, on modes of longitudinal E-wave. And as much as Heaviside was a great man, for all I know, it, when he was quoting things like that, he was still thinking of terms like the ether.
Got it. The longitudinal modes of resonant cavity are particular standing wave patterns formed by waves confined in cavity. The longitudinal modes correspond to those wavelengths of the wave which are reinforced by constructive interference. Enter here.
In waveguide.
Right, so what I'm trying to find out is, do we, by having two cones and a wire, and let's say the wire is 1 foot long, and we have two cones, and then we have those rings that are on the wire with the hole inside. Question is, could we somehow think of it as confined space? Back to you.
That so-called confined space has an awful lot of open structure to it that's radiating, and it's not very well shielded. That's my impression. Maybe your impression is different. Over to you, Roy.
No, I agree with you. It's not a waveguide. I mean, you know waveguides a hell of a lot better than I do, but by no description could you call this cone a waveguide. And I don't even think Glenn calls it a waveguide. So I think we're kind of forcing a definition where no one really wanted one.
I think we should invite Glenn. He could explain to us everything. And yeah, he doesn't seem to be a guy who is extremely tough on the subject. He didn't even say that Global was wrong. I think he was wrong. So that would be the best. He's ham radio operator. He has license. He could be on Echolink.
Comment.
I think it's you, John. Go ahead.
George, KD2FIU, in the early series. By the way, I'm not well right now. In the early series of waveguide generations, 1.7G, one of the big drawbacks was the near distances to have to regenerate the signal based on the medium of the waveguide. So the electronic light wave component on how we want to transmit this is there. It's the theory is well and in place. However, when we want to actually apply it, how we have to regenerate the signal at such short distances becomes a critical factor. KD2FIU.
Yeah, what I think you're saying is that if I'm sending a signal down a very long transmission line, say for instance a cable television system, you have to put preamplifiers, something like 10 or 15 of them per mile on a CATV system to overcome the loss of the cable, because from one end of the town to the other end of the town might be 15 miles. And so can you run 15 miles of transmission line with very low loss transmission line without any intermediate amplifiers? Of course not. So in any system that you're trying to send a information signal down it, when the distance becomes long, you're going to have to regenerate by some means or another. Add amplifiers and/or demodulators, remodulators, and retransmitters, if you know what I mean. So how you would do it on G-Line is not very different than how you would do it on coax cable. In order to invite him onto the TechNet, where we have these questions that have not yet been answered, what is the insertion loss? Where did the insertion loss numbers come from on that on those cones? I'd like to have, you've had communication with him. I'd like to have him answer that question first, Wes, because without that answer, no matter how much mathematics he has, no matter how much arm waving he has, if he can't explain this mysterious extra 4 dB of loss in the system, then we start off very skeptical as to whether or not this is a desirable kind of transmission line. Let's get that answer first. Where did the 4 dB of loss come from, what's causing it, how was that measured? N2XJN, K2RIW.
That's one of the good ways to do that, but I also found the open-ended waveguide when we were talking about what confines the waveguide. And I found also dual polarized probes, 800 megahertz to 40 gigahertz, and it looks like a bow cone. And it is on mbgworld.com. You could see it, both of them. So when you have open-ended waveguide, so it's not enclosed, my question is, what is the confined space for the waveguide? What constitutes the waveguide? What diameter of the cone is doing with the signal we're on the transmission line? And we have those discs that allow the prevent irradiating of the signal. So, will you answer the question? As much as you understand, because you were also reading his literature, we have a commercial product right now. It's being called a dual polarized probe, and it works. And now you're asking about certain questions, not allowing the guy to even ask answer for himself. We're talking about very much little of value stopping here sometime, and very much a lot of value stop sometimes. So I believe it is up to you. You are the boss. And to exchange.
A well-shielded piece of coaxial cable is extremely well isolated from the environment. It keeps the signal internal. Conventional use of waveguide is thoroughly shielded on both ends and along the length, and it's very well isolated from the environment. If I open circuit the end of a piece of a waveguide, and or put a cone, a tapered antenna there, a horn-like antenna, it's no longer a confined system. It's no longer shielded. If I have two parabolic dish antennas aimed at each other across the short distance, like you do with a periscope antenna system. A periscope antenna system is where, at the bottom of the tower, you've got a parabolic dish aimed straight up in the air. At the top of the tower, you either have a 45-degree fly swatter that redirects the antenna out to the horizon, or you could have another parabolic dish antenna receiving the signal and then converting it to your electronics. They call that beam waveguide. And so, as you make the dishes on the bottom of the tower and the top of the tower bigger and bigger in wavelengths of diameter, let me drop. As you make those dishes bigger and bigger, the amount of shielding you get of that beam waveguide system gets better and better, but it never is well shielded. Periscope antenna systems were very popular 30 years ago because they are extremely high performance. The equivalent of your transmission line going up the tower, which normally would have 8 dB of loss, the beam waveguide, the periscope antenna system, can have 1 dB of loss. And sometimes it's even got a little bit of gain. So they're very desirable. But they were outlawed because they radiate. They send signals to other things in the environment, and therefore they were given a grandfather clause, continuing use clause. If you had a system that was in operation, you were allowed to continue using it. But the FCC would not license you to install more of these systems. So because the FCC recognized them as a not well-shielded system, these two launching cones of this single-wire transmission line falls into that same category. Therefore, to get a license for using that could be very troublesome. So, we've got a number of questions here to be answered before we go jumping on this system as a great way to go of a low-loss, unique, brand-new transmission line.
Now we have existing MVG Microwave Vision Group, open-ended waveguide. It is a piece of foam with something in the middle, the easiest way. And then we had the same company, dual polarized support probes. Dr. Roy maybe found it.
Oh, I actually, I haven't been looking. I just assumed that eventually you'd send me the link and make my life easier. I'm a little confused. How does that parabola beam, is a passive antenna device, how does it give you over-unity gain? And also, I just wanted to point out that none of this is going on HF. He's dabbled in VHF. Most of his experiments he talks about seem to be in the UHF range.
Never told that he's claiming any over-unity. Over-unity doesn't exist. Only if I give you $100 and you have a zero in your pocket, then you have over-unity, because I gave you that. But we have a commercial product. The company is Microwave Vision Group, dual polarized probes. Similar to that, we have another one, which is open-ended waveguide. This one works from a frequency range up to terahertz, I believe. 280 megahertz to 110 gigahertz. What is it? It's a piece of foam lying on a table with something in the middle. It's open waveguide. So what I'm trying to find out, and I would appreciate if you could help me out, is we have two cones and 1 foot of the guide wire. When we increase the diameter of those cones, what does to the signal transmitted? And to here.
As you make the cones larger and larger, the amount of signal leaking to the environment that doesn't go from cone A to cone B, the amount leaking to the environment gets smaller. It never goes to zero. By the way, in the case of a periscope antenna system, under some circumstances, you have the equivalent of a transmission line going up the tower, which in some cases has a half a dB or 1 dB of gain for the total system. That's because the fly swatter at the top of the tower, the 45-degree object, is large enough in wavelength that it itself, as a passive reflector, is gathering more signal and it has some gain to it. So you can end up with gain by comparison to what you would have with very low loss conventional transmission line going up the tower. So the beam waveguide system, as a periscope antenna system, under some circumstances, with a big enough fly swatter at the top, appears to have gain. You see that concept there, Roy? AT2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Yes, okay, that makes sense to me. So, yeah, I misinterpreted it. The way that you said it, it just kind of hit a red flashing light. And I was not disparaging you at all, Wesley. It was Dick's comment that a greater gain for a passive antenna system, but it's in comparison to other transmission methods. So that makes sense to me now.
The fact that I can buy probe-like antennas, like for instance the ones that are used on the that system that's made in France. I'm having trouble thinking of the brand name right now. Anyhow, they make an antenna testing system, the equivalent of an anechoic chamber, where there's either 16, 32, or 64 individual cross-polarized detectors set up on this great big ring, a vertically polarized ring, which you put your device under test in the middle of the ring, and now the 64 probes make a measurement of both the horizontal and vertical component, amplitude and phase, as the device under test is being rotated. And so you get a tremendous amount of data with one simple rotation of the device under test while the measurements are being made at each individual frequency. You get the equivalent of a whole lot of conic cuts. In other words, you get a completely three-dimensional antenna pattern out of this machine, out of this French device. I can't think of the brand name of it right now. So the fact that you can make cross-polarized probes that go across very wide frequency regions, that's not magic. That's been known for a long time. So you seem to be asking a question about a very wide field probe inside of a piece of foam, And you're asking me, is that a shielded structure? Not at all. And the fact that it covers a whole lot of frequency, that's not magic. I'm not quite sure what you're asking, Wes. By the way, Wes, we've been on this subject for more than an hour. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Yeah, I know. Dick, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I'm sorry keeping you so busy. Dr. Ray.
Alcatel Systems, is that it, Dick? K2FIU.
Okay, FIU, I guess it's Gary. George. George, I'm not quite sure what you just asked. Repeat it a little bit more slowly.
I think the French company is Alcatel Systems.
Good guess. No, it's called Satimo. S-A-T-I-M-O, at least phonetically, that's the spelling. The Satimo company makes this $500,000 testing fixture, which is slowly becoming very popular because it makes a tremendous number of measurements in a short period of time. It's a very computer-intensive measuring system. And so in a 10-minute measurement of your device on the test, you get this beautiful three-dimensional antenna pattern out of this Satimo machine. And it contains 16, 32, or 64 probes that work across very wide frequency regions. And so this machine has been around for at least a decade, and there's now a couple of them on Long Island that I know about, and doing very nice work. So you look up the word Satimo, and you look at their product line. Although it's a little pricey, it's becoming a very nice way of constructing a high-performance anechoic chamber. And so I chose to discuss this right now with Wes because Satimo contains a whole lot of probes that cover a very large frequency region, K2LIW.
Very good, Dick. Thank you, because always interested in the highest level of test equipment. Left the Korea years ago. Test equipment we were working on light guide systems, had to be $400,000 or $500,000. Soaking test equipment out of the Middletown labs, and I recall at the time, as Lucent Technologies was losing its contracts, we were handing a lot off to not me. I was with AT&T, but we were handing a lot off to Alcatel Systems. And had a lot of meetings with them. That's why I mentioned that. Thank you, Dick.
Very fine, George. This Satimo system, if you buy the top of the line Cadillac version, it's in the vicinity of $500,000. But for the people who buy it, they get so darn much data in such a short period of time that they believe it pays for itself in the first year or two of operation. So they think they're getting a very large return on investment. So we've been on the subject now for over an hour, Wes, so I'm going to stop for today. And so there's a number of questions that N6GN really should answer to you first before we bring him on. I mean, if he goes into a very elaborate definition and description of what he has shown in his YouTube video without answering those basic questions that you and I and Roy have, then we could end up still a little bit confused and take up an awful lot of time. So let's get those questions answered first before we proceed with bringing him on board. Because from California to New York by way of Echolink, not as easy as you think. The people who try using Echolink and getting an edge in word-wise with us with the timeout functions that we have on these various machines between us makes it less than easy, if you know what I mean.
I agree with you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I'm sorry for keeping you so long, Dick. And to you.
Now, under normal circumstances, we go over to the mailbag at this time, but I'm not sure that John is available tonight. Let's see if he is. KC2WGB, are you online tonight, John? K2RIW in the TechNet? I think John is not available tonight. Okay, then it's time for us to go over to the space report. WS2N, Paul, as usual, a lot is going on. I know that that launch that was going to take place last week had a number of delays. Did that launch finally take place? WS2N, K2RW, proceed with space report number 232, I think it is. You've got it, Paul.
Good evening, Dick, and everybody else. Yeah, this is WS2N, and that was the Cygnus satellite. They did finally get up. It was on Thursday, and it was the same time in the morning, roughly 8:30. And the Pegasus rocket was taken up in the air by the L-1011, and Orbital ATK is the company that was involved with this. They were the ones using the Pegasus rocket. The Cygnus itself, the eight satellites that were launched were built by SNC, Sierra Nevada Corporation. They're the same ones. They do a lot of satellite work, but they're the same ones building the Dream Chaser spacecraft. So a lot of people, they get together when they have some of these launches. Satellite was built by them and launched by Orbital ATK down in Florida. Let me drop it. And I finally got to see it. They delayed that first day. That was on Monday. And that was due to, originally they were saying a hydraulic pump had possibly had failed because the circuit breaker kept kicking out. And they thought that there was a short in the in this three-phase connection that was knocking out the 20-amp breaker. But after getting the whole setup back down on the ground and looking at it, they determined that it was the actual breaker that was failing, and they sent another one in from California. They flew it in and installed it into the jet. What the hydraulic pump does is it creates pressure for these half a dozen latches that open up and allows this rocket to drop from the spacecraft, from the carrier plane, the L-1011, and without being able to do that, they canceled that day, and then they thought they could get up the next day, but because of the time lag for getting the special breaker that they needed out to the for replacement, they waited 2 days till Wednesday. And Wednesday came along, and they decided, well, we're going to have to wait till Thursday, because then they found a software problem that the satellites, all these satellites, needed to be updated on. And that this way they killed a little bit more time, and they did launch it on Thursday morning, which was beautiful weather. They got up to about 100 miles outside of Daytona, out over the Atlantic.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
They got 100 miles out over the Atlantic, about 40,000 miles up in the air, 600 miles an hour. And they dropped the Pegasus with the eight Cygnus satellites on board. And 5 seconds later, the three-stage solid booster, solid air rocket, three stages, they're all solids, pushed the satellite to roughly a 300-mile high, 35 degrees in inclination. And this rocket's about 60 feet long, 57 feet long. It's got about 20-foot wingspan, has a wing on board. So after that stage separates, that wing drops with it, and eventually you're just left with the third stage and the satellite. And that whole rocket weighs a little over 50,000 pounds. And eventually the goal is to separate these satellites too. They all separated 30 seconds apart, all eight of them. And over time, they're going to drift apart to about 5,000 kilometers apart from one another. Each of these little satellites weigh about 60 pounds, a little over 60 pounds. They have a little over 5.5 foot wingspan, and that's what they use. They truly act as a wing, even so they're solar panels. They pick up some of the rarefied gas that's in the atmosphere to actually slow them down. And one's up in front, you know, they stay at the normal speed, but the other one's stripped behind it. And when they get to their location, they reorient themselves so they don't hit the rarefied air head on anymore, and they'll stay at 5,000 kilometers apart for a couple of years. So the signs should be start coming back in about another month or so. They're going to wait about a month or so before they can calibrate everything. Low power, solar panels only, they only need 37 watts for each satellite. And the way it works, they pick up the signals from the GPS satellites. And the whole idea of these things is to look at into the eye of these hurricanes. You know, instead of sending a hurricane aircraft in there, you know, every, you know, maybe twice a day, you know, when they get close to land, this thing could get readings roughly every 15 minutes. They'll see how it goes, and this is kind of a proof of concept type of thing. If it works for the next 2 years, that's what they're hoping for, a minimum of 2 years. They might be able to develop further satellites that they could launch in a similar fashion. And that's the story on Cygnus. Let me drop it. Very good to watch, though. It was I've seen a lot of replays of these things. Pegasus has launched, they said, 42 times before from different locations around the globe. So this is interesting to see fly out of the East Coast. That hasn't happened since 2003. So another spacecraft that has gotten to where it's going is the one that was launched by Japan, the HTV-6. Launched on a H-2B rocket from Japan. It's brought up a little over 10,000 pounds of stuff to the International Space Station. So that worked out good. Shane Kimbrough, the astronaut, American astronaut on board, his ESA, the European Space Agency counterpart, grabbed the satellite when it got nearby. The satellite's big. It's cargo craft is like 30 feet long and 14 feet in diameter. And they grabbed it with a robotic arm, and they attached it to the Harmony node, one of the modules on the space station. The Earth facing port, the end of the year port. And now they're able to get in there and take everything out. They got all kinds of food, water, and a lot of science racks. And it'll stay attached for, I guess, a couple of months before they detach the Japanese cargo vehicle, which will eventually burn up in the atmosphere. On board this cargo vehicle, they have a pressurized area that you can go into to take stuff out. And then in the back, they have an open area that the robotic arm will eventually grab a hold of this skid. On the skid has six lithium-ion batteries. And these are big batteries. Each battery is like over 500 pounds. They're going to attach them to one of the locations on the International Space Station. Not inside, but on the outside near the solar panels. The batteries that are up there now are aging, so they need replacement. replacement batteries. One's going to rub there. They're going to disconnect and actually attach it to the spacecraft. Not all of them, but some of them. And then they'll burn up in the atmosphere when they go back away from the space station. But for now, they're going to store them, and then they're going to do a couple of spacewalks. And the space robot, the Dextra robot that's outside the space station, is going to give them a hand. They'll be attaching the these big batteries. They'll be disconnecting all batteries and attaching new lithium-ion batteries in its place. The old batteries were not lithium-ion. They were, you know, it was batteries that they designed years ago, and now lithium-ion has taken over. The old ones are nickel hydrate, not nickel metal hydrate, but nickel hydrate, or nickel hydrogen batteries is really what they call them. And they're going to get rid of them, and it's like a 2-to-1 ratio. You know, you have 6 lithium-ion batteries. It's going to replace 12 of the existing batteries. So naturally, you got twice the amount of amp hours capability on the lithium-ion. So, now, this is going to happen a couple of times, and in next year, another cargo vehicle from, for instance, from Japan will go up there and they'll do the same thing. So they have six batteries this time, next time six more, and six more after that. You know, a total of about, you know, 2 dozen replacement batteries are going to replace 24 existing batteries. You know, so it's a work that's going to take many years, actually, to complete, probably, you know, 4 years or so. Let me drop it. This is WS2M. So that's pretty much it on the main topics. There was a launch today down in Cape Canaveral. And that was NAPA 5 in the 4, I believe it was 4-3-1 configuration. That's, yeah, you know, for Atlas 4 with the 4-meter diameter fairing on top, the 3 solid boosters attached to it, and 1 Centaur liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen stage for the upper stage to push Echo Star 19 into orbit for the United States, you know, for us. And that's going to geosynchronous orbit, and it's going to help the companies use that has internet satellites already up there, and it's going to add to it. So that was today. That was very hard to find on the internet. I found out by going to a ULA launch. They have a website that you can go to live launches for the ULA, United Launch Alliance launches. So, between that and the Juno mission, Cassini, there's a lot of things going on. Juno's still doing good. Cassini's got, I guess, September will be the end of the Cassini mission around Saturn. But Juno around Jupiter is doing good. They got some rocket problems, but they're working through that. I'll turn it back to you, Dick, for questions and comments, you know, from anybody else. And if anybody wants to contact me, I can be reached at spacenetreport@gmail.com. This is WS2M. Back to you, Dick.
Net time complete.
Okay. I think the 4 beeps are now going to either not be there or act differently. Anyone else have any further questions for Paul on the space report, what you've heard so far, or anything else to do with space? If you'd like to ask Paul a question about space, please give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNav.
Yeah, I have a question. I may have answered this before. I've got a different answer to a direct question. W2OY. What is the sensitivity of the receiving equipment on board? Because you've talked about this a few times, but I've never heard you actually mention it if you know what the receiving sensitivity of the equipment is, because apparently it was made like 40 years ago. I was just wondering how good the stuff was 40-something years ago, excluding the gain of the dish and so forth. Do you happen to know that answer? For which satellite? Are you talking about the space station or Voyager?
You're talking about Voyager. You're talking about Voyager, and I have made an estimation on that. Before I give you my estimation, you may have more direct data as to what is the sensitivity of the raw receiver, independent of the dish. The raw receiver on Voyager, he wants to know what that sensitivity is, if you happen to know. WS2N, K2LIW.
No, I don't know what the sensitivity is now, but I know it transmits. It. Well, as a couple of years ago, it was 24 watts, and they have traveling wave tubes, two of them on board. But as far as the sensitivity, no. That was probably the indirect answer I gave to you, Joe. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. I know for a fact that Voyager most likely... I shouldn't say no for a fact. Most likely, Voyager has a mixer front end. No low noise preamplifier. Its uplink is around 8.5 gigahertz. I lived through the period of time when the state-of-the-art electronics was being developed in 1977. I was actively operating at Airborne Instruments Laboratory at the time. Nobody had a reliable space-qualified low-noise amplifier for X-band in 1977. This is the best of all worlds. You'd like to have a low-noise amplifier in the front end in front of the mixer, because a raw mixer has something in the vicinity of an 8-decibel noise figure. In other words, whatever sensitivity you think you could get out of a good low-noise amplifier, you're going to be at least 8 decibels. You're going to be at least 8 decibels less sensitive when you use a mixer front end. But that's not a disadvantage when it comes to Voyager, because on the ground you've got this 240-foot diameter dish at Goldstone, California, with at least a 10-kilowatt transmitter. So you have a huge amount of uplink effective isotropic radiated power. We could calculate how many terawatts of effective radiated power comes out of that Goldstone dish, so it can overcome a very noisy receiver. So, in order to get reliability, it had to be a mixer front end, I believe, because no preamplifier would tolerate space. And the nice thing about a preamplifier in front of your spacecraft is a good sensitivity. If the preamplifier, with its very delicate gas-fed transistor, should go into a failure mode because it just got blasted with some cosmic rays in space, all of a sudden your receiver goes completely dead, because that preamplifier, instead of giving you 20 dB of gain, gives you 30 dB of loss, because the transistor just got blasted. So that gives you very low reliability, whereas a mixer front end can be made very robust. So I'm guessing a mixer front end, okay? An 8 dB noise figure mixer front end would have a sensitivity of, let's see now, 113 dBm per megacycle, 10 dB signal to noise ratio. It would have minus 103 dB of sensitivity if it had a 1 megahertz receiver bandwidth. But because they're now running the system in the 50 bits per second transmit mode, let me drop. In theory, they can also run the receiver, something equally narrow band. If I compare 50 hertz, which I'm doing right now, versus exponential 6, 1 megahertz, that ratio, 20 log, 10 log, yeah, that's 43 dB. You get 43 dB of increased sensitivity from minus 103. 43 minus 103 gives me roughly minus 146. A good rough guess. That receiver has a sensitivity on Voyager of around minus 146 dBm, because even though it has an 8 dB noise figure, raw mixer front end. Those are a bunch of guesses. And you combine that with the dish on board, which is 12 foot in diameter, which has got, I don't know the exact number, something like 43 dB of gain, and you realize that they have no trouble with uplink power. Voyager is only limited in downlink power. It only has a 6, 8, 10 watts of transmit power into the 12.